Hi, I'm Stargate Pioneer from Better Podcasting, a proud member of the Gonna Geek Network, just like the show you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual host. Check out all the other podcasts at GonnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
Hello, I'm Colin Baker, known to my friends as Old Sixy, the Sixth Doctor in that wonderful series Doctor Who. And I am proud to tell you, you are listening to me, and also Gallifrey Public Radio, the radio that brings you everything from Doctor Who to Rhino Wants a Wife, which is a book written by Lucy Baker, my daughter. It's a children's book. You can get it from fbspublishing.co.uk, and it's about a rhinoceros who is lonely and wants a wife, and it's illustrated by my other daughter's boyfriend, and it's a bargain. Buy it!
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. We invite you to join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi and beyond. Your GPR staff are Jay Witten.
You see how clever I was there? You make that connection? Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Keir Hansen.
Proactive. Reactive. Proactive. I'm making up words as I go here.
And Haley Malley.
Hey, that wasn't exactly what I was going to say at all, Jay. Thanks.
Oh, and
spoilers.
We do occasionally discuss recent news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired in their home territories. But don't worry, if we dip too far into the future, we'll give you fair warning. Welcome to episode 234 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we've gotten an email from ourselves warning us not to ponder the intricacies of what we've just watched, for only madness lies therein. But knowing ourselves, though, we didn't heed that warning, so hey, insanity! Oh, and by the way, someone get Dan Brown on the line and tell him that he can officially stop mingling techno-mystery and organized religion now, because we have officially closed the loop. I'm your host. My name is Keir Hansen, and joining me in the studios, as always, my partner in time, Jay Witten. Jay, what's going on?
It's really dark in here for some reason. I don't know what's going on, but I've got these really cool glasses that kind of have like this matrix. It works well.
And over to my left, holding a red pill and a blue pill, Haley Malley. Haley, what's going on?
I will smash them both together and grind them up and snort them.
Whatever gets you through this episode. Jay, what's going on tonight? Oh.
So this week we take a clear and distinctive break from the single-shot adventure stories that have defined Series 10 so far. And we let the mind of Stephen Moffat impress and confuse us with the beginning of a three-part arc, Extremis. So from Popes in the Bedroom to Matrix-like revelations about the reality as we know it, to a viral email attachment that makes WannaCry look like a retweeted cat video, this is thoroughly dense and complicated start to what will surely be a trio of head-scratchers.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Show of hands, how many of us decided that we needed to, as quickly as possible, watch this one again to try and figure out what we just saw after this ended?
Yeah, I think I've seen it 4 times now.
Okay, still seeing layers upon layers?
Yeah, still pulling stuff out of it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And Haley, what about you?
I feel like I at least got the when is reality and when isn't reality on my second watch.
Okay, yeah. That was one of the certain things that I wanted to try to gather, was which was virtual Doctor and Bill, which was true Doctor. Apparently we only see true Doctor present day. I mean, we got our very long ago, which apparently is 1,000 years officially, give or take. Although,
well, we don't know where he is on that 1,000-year term.
Yeah. Okay. So that's an interesting point. Mm-hmm. So, all right. We knew we were going to see Michelle Gomez again. We had all kind of assumed, well, she's probably the most likely one in the vault. And a lot of people got kind of butthurt that it actually turned out to be her in the vault. They wanted a red herring, you know, and some sort of crazy reveal. And they actually got...
So they didn't want it to be the obvious choice.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to begrudge a show that sets up a mystery and then the solution that it should be is the solution. Like,
right.
You know,
not everything has to be the
companion from 37 years ago in there just to trick us or something. Like, it makes sense for it to be Missy in the box, which is why we figured it out.
Ow, I got, ow, Occam's razor. So sharp.
Right.
But that's, I mean, at this point, I think the only thing that I had a bit of an issue with was how quickly, like, it almost just got thrown out there. You know, he was, like, leaning up against the vault door, and he's just talking over his shoulder. Missy, you wouldn't believe what's going on.
Yeah.
Like, okay, we're done with the mystery now, guys.
Tease me a little bit.
But that's the thing, is the fact that it was the most obvious solution. So do we really need it to be stretched out? It's like, okay, we've all kind of figured out that it's Missy, and, yep, there's confirmation. We're good. We don't.
Yeah.
Maybe if they hadn't waited until episode 6 to confirm it. Mm. Like, if you're going to pretend like it's a mystery for 5 episodes, to just throw it out there for us in episode 6.
Yeah, I guess. But had they, like, dragged it out through the whole episode, and then at the very end he was like, Missy. Well, I mean, you'd have been like, really? That it got dragged out that long for this? Like,
I suppose, I don't know. Because I look at how carefully they did the execution scene. Right, mm-hmm. the early stage of the execution.
I picked
the prisoner
up on that
will
too,
kneel. You know, the camera cutting back and forth. Who's the Time Lord? Who's actually getting executed? And who's the one doing the executing? Ooh, a little mini mystery within the mystery.
Well, it was kind of a mystery whether it was, you know, Missy still alive or just Missy's body in there that he was talking to. But we had heard the piano music before.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you don't usually feed takeaway to a corpse. So
We haven't seen a lot of Time Lord corpses. How would we know?
Life is a tricky enemy.
I don't know.
But I have to say that I adored every scene from the execution planet.
Like, yeah.
All of it was just brilliant. I loved it.
Got a very Game of Thrones feel. You know,
I said Westeros when we came up to that castle.
The boat through the caverns. That jacket. That freaking jacket, man.
Oh, yes. Dear God. That was on point.
And you're not going to find that one off the shelf, kids. You know, that was built custom for Capaldi. Although a lot of cosplayers will get to their sewing machines and start distressing the hell out of whatever that material may have been, but so my question, since we're on that topic, you know, and we've been dealing with this absolutely phenomenal frenemy relationship that I think has reached a level between these two actors that has been decades in the making, you know, mm-hmm. from true arch nemesis to something that has become, you know, we've gotten a little bit more of their backstory filled in or written, you know, because we didn't know it before, so they developed it, but everyone has sort of really bought into it and created this amazing relationship where they will confound one another at every turn, nearly kill one another at every opportunity, but will also protect each other with their own lives. I have to wonder, when we get to the point, and I know I'm kind of jumping a little bit because we have to talk about River's epitaph, but when that is thrown from the Doctor to her, and she answers with such seeming sincerity, how much of it on both of their parts do you think was genuine, and how much of it was part of the show they were putting on because they both knew the Doctor rigged the machine?
I don't know. The way that it plays out is kind of the way that I took it, was that, you know, the Doctor really didn't know what he was going to do up until that last moment. You know, he was genuinely asking her, you know, are you going to, is this for real? You know, will you really change your ways or that kind of thing? And he wanted to gauge her reaction. That's kind of the way that I have it in my head. I'm probably very wrong, but still.
I'm remembering a parable about a scorpion right now.
Yeah.
I've never been.
I mean, and that's the thing. Like, the minute that Missy says, you know, I'll turn good, you know, you're like, okay, how long is this going to last? We all know that it's going to.
I believe she was the one that said, "No, I haven't turned good."
Yeah. So I mean, we all know that it's not going to last. You know, she played the Doctor. She did what she needed to stay alive, like she always does. Mm. And
but you'll notice at the end, she wasn't saying, "Yes, I'm good." She was saying, "Yes, I am your friend."
Right.
Like, she used the words he'd used describing good, but she was saying, you know, I might be straight up evil and crazy, but I am your friend.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that's something they're both toying with. You know, when he dances around the legality of the oath that he took. Well, I promised to watch the body for 1,000 years.
I never said it had to be dead first.
Right. Yeah. This is,
you know, paralegal 101 here. But yeah, I guess there's, so we know this is pretty much a certainty. We're not done with Michelle Gomez. We will at least see her, I would imagine, in one of the two parts to follow, if not both. But it's been, you know, as she's expressed, she's walking away from this character at the end of the season because she's, all my friends are leaving, so I'm leaving too. This led me to believe about to wonder a little bit about the River Song character again, because obviously, you know, Moffat's going to play that card probably until Capaldi exits, because this is where everything came to its close. And it was tough. It was definitely tough seeing her diary, you know, hearing her words from, you know, beyond the grave, literally, getting thrown back at the doctor to keep him in check. So I have to wonder, are we at a position where we may get, you know, kind of as we've done with Amy Pond and characters past, where the doctor at a point of regeneration gets revisited by his companions and people of significance, you know, if he has a moment where he can actually reflect on those things, whether it's spinning heads around his face as he falls from a high tower, or actually gets a vision of someone visiting him personally and having a conversation with him, are we going to get a little hint of Alex Kingston before we're done? Or is this just Moffat saying one last time, you know, I think I created something really exceptional here and I'm pretty damn proud of it. So if this is one of the last episodes I get to write, I'm going to do her right.
I don't think that we're going to see her again. I think that the way that she went out was pitch perfect. They don't need to bring her back for that one last aw moment. And that was kind of, that kind of got voiced when, you know, Missy brought it up. She's like, you know, I heard you were, you know, living happily on Drillium. You know, what happened with that? And the doctor doesn't say anything. She's like, okay, my condolences. You know, it was that acknowledgement that this is truly over. Things are done moving forward. Mm-hmm. Like, we'll still get callbacks to her, but we're not going to see her again.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's true, because we know if this is Moffat's swan song, this season is, I feel like he might want to give himself one last time to say goodbye to River before he goes.
Oh, he's pulling out all the stops. Everybody's coming back. It's a big clip show. Yeah. Oh my God. Last episode were a clip show?
Oh God.
Let's look back at all the great times Stephen Moffat had. Wow.
All you'd see is a bunch of people dying and then not being dead the next season.
Although the slaughter continues and the Moffat has learned his lesson by series 10. And everybody's dying.
Yeah, except none of those were real people.
This time around, yeah.
Yeah.
But, okay, so just to kind of close the book, close the book on River. We at least have the final connecting thread that says how Nardal's gotten into the picture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He has the authority to kick the doctor's ass.
And yours too, baby doll.
That was brilliant.
I don't know. I like the fact that he's been given a bit of an edge at times.
Yeah.
Granted, he then does, you know, the Scooby and Shaggy yip the moment he sees a body, but
that was the perfect counterpoint though, and I like that we did get the, you know, we know why he's there now. It's not because the doctor needed him; it's because River knew that the doctor needed him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know,
and
she knew
the more formidable person to cross.
Exactly.
Yeah. So we know whose orders he's really under, and that's why he's so stringent about these things. And it all makes perfect sense now.
But I mean, I'm surprised that six episodes after I was, you know, clamoring for an early exit of Nardal, I absolutely love him. I love what they've done with him so far, and he's been great through everything that we've seen him so far. They've used him the right amount up to this point. And then in this one, it was, you know, the doctor had to be able to face this stuff on his own, and you needed somebody to be there with Bill, and it just made perfect sense to have the two of them running around. So I'm enjoying it so far.
I gotta say, when it comes to this, I'm watching through, you know, I watch what each of the characters are going through this particular episode, because it tends to be something where the realizations that they're coming to, whether they want to accept them or not, you know, at each stage, whether it's the realization of Missy that this is actually potentially her final moments, whether it's the doctor's realization, on the execution planet that he actually has to go through with this, or the virtual doctor's realization of where he fits in the bigger picture of what's really going on. All of these moments, Bill's realization when she's in CERN with Nardal and everything's about to blow, and they finally get the explanation of what Veritas really is. The only phrase that kept coming back to mind, and I'm still trying to see how it fits with everybody of significance through here, is the term scar tissue. The idea of whether it's the matter of this is an episode where scar tissue is formed, or this is one where you rely on that as the tough point in your skin that allows you to be able to get through something of particular difficulty, or just something that is an itch that doesn't quite ever go away. And you know, I was kind of playing with this metaphor. I'm seeing what the doctor's dealing with, seeing what Bill's dealing with things like trying to balance, you know, now we're finally getting her trying to balance her personal life. Sorry, Pope in the bedroom. With her life of adventure. And I think now we're really getting a better balance. It seemed a little stunted at times in previous episodes, still acceptable, but it seemed like she brushed off things very quickly because the script demanded it. And here I think she's still carrying sufficient amount of it. She's getting genuinely angry at these instances where the doctor's presumptuousness interferes with her life as she's trying to maintain, whether it's her social life or just her, the preservation of her life, you know, but I think the doctor's recognizing that too. It's the whole reason why he doesn't want her to know that he's blind, because then she'll care about me, you know, and that whole concern.
Right. But I like Nardal's counterpoint to that is like, no, if you tell her, then it becomes real and you have to deal with it.
Right. Again, scar tissue. You know, you'd think you'd learned your lesson from all the wounds that you carry, but you still try to live this life of solitude. But at the same time, the duality of it is you always need to have someone around. Whether you need someone to remind you or whether you come to that conclusion on your own, you need somebody at your side, and yet you still don't completely confide in them. So, you know, you're at war with yourself. In Nardal's case, the fact that he's stuck himself in this, you know, he's bequeathed himself to this position, and it's kind of, you know, when he realizes that's the, you know, when he reaches through the back of the projection, you know, and that cry out to Bill, I think was very genuine. I think that terror and that concern, because he didn't have the bigger solution. At that point, he was just doing it as a self-sacrifice. He was experimenting with it and ended up getting caught unaware. So that's that was a pretty bold gesture on his part. Very kind of heroic in its own way.
Yeah. No, it was good to see him playing, you know, the Dr. Light, basically.
Mm. Again, it seems like the voice of the classic Who fan.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're the ones that say, well, you know, if you remember correctly, you know, we've seen alien technology of this sort before, and da 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 da, you know, and start to try to piece it apart, a la the Doctor would. Bill will get to that point, I'm sure, but it's when it comes to that. Speaking of those projectors and everything, so let's look at this. The are we just calling them the monks? Are they the truth monks, or what? Do they have a kind of a working title? I always call them the monks of Veritas because I don't. Honestly, no.
that works, actually.
The mummy monks.
Yeah.
The monkeys. Monk mummies.
No.
Monkeys?
No.
Not the monkeys? Okay. Monkeys. The monkeys. That's it. We're going to hashtag it. It's going to be real by tomorrow. So the monkeys having this plot for at least global domination, if not beyond, by sitting here and doing all of these reality simulations. Each one specific. So it wasn't one where you could tell, oh, this must be an alternate reality because Eric Stoltz actually played Marty McFly in Back to the Future or anything like that. This was all like to the letter.
This isn't Earth 19. Yeah.
Yeah. So no fringe universes here. But they're doing these multiple tests to just see where the breakdown occurs. And it's kind of it's like the Groundhog Day test. You know, oh, the humans get a little bit farther this time, a little bit farther this time, a little bit farther. But such an accurate simulation that the doctor, the virtual doctor, becomes self-aware and able to warn his real self through the system. So,
trapping the bad guys in their own trap.
How did this sit with you as far as that little bit of techno hand wavium?
I liked it. I feel like it was one of the twists that they actually executed well, like all the way through the story. Because when you go back and watch it the second time, you're like, oh, I see where there's that part and then there's that part. And
okay.
It holds up to rewatching.
Yeah. I don't think I was being more and more critical with every rewatch, which I normally do.
And honestly, when you put it in, it does make a bit of sense. Like, if you're going to make a program that is so completely accurate that it's going to be the Doctor, then yeah, he's totally going to be able to figure something like that out. And it might be a little, you know, sonic witchcraft because that's what he does, but you know, it fits with the rest of it. So why not?
I kind of wonder, to a certain degree, there are two things that stood out as far as things that were newly introduced within this storyline, or now story arc, as we know it'll be, that just sat funny with me. And I'm still working it through, but the monks are one of them. If they are such a hyper-intelligent, unknown entity, how have they remained unknown for all this time? Have they just been biding their time, not really messing with anyone else in reality, and dealing with their little virtual simulations that are nearly impeccably detailed and accurate, just so they can just plan everything out? You know, they're the consummate, you know, over-prepared villains, so no one's really minding them much. And then they're just going to unleash hell.
Well, like, they've never actually done anything yet, because when they do something, they're going to do it all at once.
Right.
So no one's had a chance to prepare for this impending doom.
Yeah, they haven't done anything bad in the real world because they've been just playing Grand Theft Auto up to this point and getting really, really good at it.
Yeah.
And then the other thing was that device that the Doctor cracked out.
The sight restore device?
Yeah. I'm calling it the external drive of future regeneration energy.
The neural MacGuffin.
Oh, jeez.
It is. Yeah. It's from Western Digital MacGuffin edition.
Yeah.
The thing that, because I don't mind what it was or what it was supposed to do, didn't really seem like it fit within the whole regenerative energy thing, because it didn't really have, I want some orange glow. If you're going to heal yourself, I want some orange glow.
Yep.
But if he has had something like this, it seems a risky thing to introduce now, because it opens up,
you know, maybe it's not something that exists in the real world, but within the simulation, they needed the blind doctor to be able to read the book to see how he would react.
I don't know. To me, it's more a thing of, like, either it serves a very specific purpose, which is, specifically, if you become blind because of...
In case of blindness, break glass.
In case of blindness due to not having oxygen in space. You know, or it's something that had always just had such a high price tag that the doctor was never desperate enough to need it.
Okay. Because then everything that he threw out there as far as the potential risks, which, by the way, he was getting very, very talky with the Cardinal.
Yeah.
Do you often really just expound like a supervillain like that? But, you know, say, oh, all my future regenerations could be blind. I may never regenerate at all. I could die in 20 minutes. Well, that's like Moffat saying, you know, I'm etch-a-sketching the rest of this season, and you have no idea what's going to happen.
Well, here's the thing. I unless they're going to bring that device back in, like, a later episode that's part of this arc, I wish they hadn't gone on so long with that expounding in this episode, because once the second watch, you're like, well, we know that's not going to happen because this isn't real. This is a simulation. So these consequences he's talking about aren't consequences we're going to have to deal with.
Yes.
Can you imagine moving forward into the next Doctor actually being blind? Like, just putting that on that kind of restriction on the show moving forward would be, I would love to see how somebody could actually work with that.
Yeah. Although I didn't really like the way the sonic shades were playing off in this one. You know, it was just very Matrix-y, you know, almost to a distracting degree. That was the only parts of the only scenes where I said, all right, let's get through it. All right. Yeah, Nardole's going to explain. Oh, there's a blue light around a corner about 10 feet away.
See, I thought this was the best they had ever used the sonic shades, because it made sense the way they were using them.
Yes.
Whereas there were other times where I was like, that makes no sense to use the sonic shades there.
Yeah.
Yeah, my thing was going to be, is there ever a point where you've been okay with the sonic shades? Because not on this end.
But his sonic, even in the virtual reality, though, if that's been if it's been running parallel with true reality, subjective, and the doctor's blind in the virtual reality as well and contending with that, how did he get his Sonic back?
Because this was a framework or matrix or whatever that was created before he destroyed the Sonic in the last episode. Like, that's happened very recently. So they hadn't updated, or they're unaware that an update is even required.
But he's blind.
Oh, yeah.
Or the TARDIS just, he went in and set it in the slot. And
that's
the TARDIS
right.
Said,
this was a TARDIS-designed screwdriver. Yeah. So he handed it back, said, I'm sorry. Put it in the bin. New one popped out with a label on it. Don't screw this one up. Your red mode has been taken away from you for a year.
Do you have any idea how much these cost?
These don't grow on trees. Well, actually, in the heart of the TARDIS, they do grow on trees. The wish tree.
But still, take better care of your things.
Yeah. God, there's just so much in this episode. All right. So the realization that you're all just a bunch of holograms, you're running on an algorithm where, from a programmer's perspective, no, random number generators don't work that way.
Yes.
But you talk a good talk. I like where you're going with it.
Or maybe these people don't know the aliens or the monkeys, whatever we're calling them.
Monkeys.
They don't know random number generators. Like, they haven't reached that. They can make super realistic VR, but they have not figured out how to make an RNG.
Yeah.
Totally viable. Yep. Going with that one. Headcanon accepted.
Even Google Chrome can give me a random number.
Siri, flip a coin.
But upon the realization, they all want to commit suicide.
Mm-hmm.
I do like, it seems a little bit of a stretch, but I like the statement behind it, that their sacrifice, call it suicide, but in this point, Doctor uses a horrible metaphor about Super Mario deciding he's sick of dying and wants to exit the game.
And deletes himself,
probably could have been a little bit more profound than that, but the whole idea of using it as an act of rebellion. The Doctor just happens to be a VR construct that thinks a little bit differently and decides, well, rather than just offing myself and the nearest 300 people around me, I'm going to try to get word out to, if you want to extend the Matrix metaphor, the copper tops out there. So when we get back to reality and the Doctor talks to Bill and basically says, you know that booty call you've been thinking about?
Go for it, because you're not going to have time.
Yeah. We might not get through this. So if you're looking for some sort of a romantic connection here, and
get while the getting's good.
Yeah, if you've been dragging your feet, act now, because I don't know how this is going to turn out. This one's beyond me. I thought, and I tweeted as much, because I couldn't figure out what was bothering me about this, because I was bothered at the end of the first viewing, not only because of confusion factor, just complicated factor, just so much to unpack.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was seeing from the Doctor, the very quiet moments, the very pensive moments, the troubled moments, whether it was virtual Doctor, true Doctor, Doctor 1,000 years ago or somewhere near 1,000 years ago, long, long time ago, present day Doctor outside the vault, I was seeing this very uncomfortable combination of fragility and determination. He looked and spoke as if he were at a breaking point. Like he was at he couldn't figure out what to do, especially when he was just outside the vault and pleading with Missy from behind the door. You know, really, really at one of his most vulnerable stages I've ever seen, at least from 12th Doctor. But at the same time, absolutely determined not to let this go quietly. He was not going to lay down. He'd never give up, never surrender. So it sat so uncomfortably with me that I kept wanting to rewatch it just to try and see whether it was something where one side or the other was winning out. But he literally, if you take it line for line down the script, he straddles it to the final seconds, which I think is an exceptionally well-constructed episode and particularly a well-written episode for all of its, kind of Moffat quirkiness. But am I the only one that kind of was dealing with that conflict within the Doctor?
I kind of think it's something we've seen before on the eve of the big battles he goes into, where like he knows he might not make it through this, but that's who he is. He's going to fight the good fight all the way to the end, even if it means the end of him. That's the sacrifice he's willing to make. He just, he's at more of a disadvantage than he has been going in before because he's blind and he's not sure how he's going to do this.
I guess the blindness and just his unpreparedness for this. This is a complete unknown. For everything that he always seems to have at least a little bit of a working knowledge from, he's absolutely unprepared for this. Mm-hmm. And is fully aware of that unpreparedness, which I think terrifies him even more. And he doesn't even want Bill involved. He keeps trying to protect her. He can barely protect himself.
Yeah.
So the rest of us, we're screwed.
It'll be interesting to see how the next two episodes tie in with this one.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to some serious character growth from both the Doctor and Bill. I think, and you know, we talked about it before, how we're, you know, eventually we're going to get Bill as the Doctor Light. But in this one, it made sense to have Nardole filling that role because Bill's not quite there yet. I expect by the end of this three-parter, Bill is going to be there. This is what's going to get her to the point where she can start to think like the Doctor, that she can start to pull that kind of thing off.
Well, and we've talked about this before. Up to this point, she had like a bunch of back-to-back adventures, but she hasn't really had time to grow into a more experienced companion. She's just kind of been thrown into the deep end a couple times.
Although I have to say, one of my favorite parts of this episode is when she's sitting at the table with her date and you start to hear the TARDIS sound and the look on her face was so perfect.
Yes. And telling all of these papal cardinals that they're going to hell.
That was really...
The dialogue all through this episode was spot on. Just
brilliant. I mean, it was Moffat.
Yeah.
If anyone's gonna nail it as far as just the right amount of snark, the right word at the right time, the right quip at the right time, this is where you're gonna go to.
Yeah,
I think it's the some of the things that I think really are the carryovers that I want to watch for specifically. Obviously, you know, we're still wondering how long the Doctor's blindness is going to persist. I think Haley, you and I were talking about this last week. We thought it was going to kind of get resolved.
I think it's going to get resolved during this arc. I don't think it's something they're going to want to carry through for the entire series and saddle Capaldi with that on his final season.
Yeah.
Jay, do you have a kind of a theory as to...
No, I mean, I agree with that. I wouldn't have been surprised if it got wrapped up in this episode. But at the same time, it's dropping it at the end of one episode just to wrap it up in the next one seems kind of cheap. So, having it stretch out throughout this three-parter would make more sense. I agree. I don't think that that's something that they're really going to try and carry out for too much longer because there's still a lot of the series left that, you know, you don't want to burden your writers with that, much less the actors. So, I expect it'll be wrapped up fairly soon.
I know in some of the behind-the-scenes stuff when they were talking to Jamie Matheson about when he was writing the previous episode and talking about the fact that he had to establish the blindness because it was something that Moffat wanted going into the story. He thought it was... He got a kick out of it. He loved the idea of having to figure out how this was going to be established and wondering himself, as a fan, how it was going to end up actually factoring into the stories to follow. I know they actually, at the close of Oxygen, when you get that final moment where he's talking to Nardole back in the university offices or back in his offices, and he says to him, I'll never see anything ever again. And then it goes to black and you hear him say, I'm still blind. Yeah. They shot that two different ways. Or actually, I should say, recorded it two different ways. When they originally did it, which was in the some trailer that they ran early on, he said it like with more concern. I'm still blind, you know, whereas what we saw at the end of the actual episode, he kind of whispered it as if it was this dramatic, tense thing. I'm still blind. So, which I understand the decision. They really wanted to kind of play that up, but it was showing the kind of cognizance they had towards the way that they were putting their character at a disadvantage he was not prepared for. If he got angry about it, you get a certain reaction from the Doctor. You know, when he gets angry, certain things happen. When he gets concerned and worried, very different things occur. And I think that says something about where they were trying to spin this. I still think our theories, we've been talking about how he's actually now reality doctor is actually going to going to get his eyesight back. I still think Missy's going to give him some of her juice.
Or he siphons some off when we see Sim's master regenerate.
He reaches Missy. In. Oh, while you're doing that regen, let me just lean in there.
And that's why they feel so connected.
We share
mojo. They bring back Susan just so he can steal her regeneration energy.
Oh, it's family juju.
That sounded dirty.
Maybe I'll edit that out later. I don't know. Oh, and then cute little moment. Haley and I were talking about this before we started recording. So Pope Benedict IX only serves to boost Google search rank, apparently. Because exactly. If you wanted to see how accurate that story was, and apparently it was the legend of Pope Joan, Pope Benedict IX actually existed and was a right bastard of a pope. Apparently was...
He was a tool three times as the pope.
Yeah, he was a pope three times because the first time he got... His dad bought him the papacy.
He was somewhere between the age of 12 and 20.
Yep. He kept getting expelled from the papacy because of adultery, murders, sodomy. I mean, he's just not exactly papal material. But then
he's going to have his own papacy with blackjack and hookers.
He said, I'm back. I hope you miss me. And got rid of him again. Third time. I'm back. Hey.
I picture him as the Richard Nixon in Futurama. Richard Nixon's head that comes back to be president again.
But somehow, because of the extreme bizarrety of this particular pope's tenure, it also got mixed in with this legend, Catholic legend, of Pope Joan, who apparently may have hidden her gender to attain the papacy and so forth, and it's been kind of widely disregarded, but it makes for great wrinkles in the fabric of papal history. Pope Benedict IX. Look it up on Wikipedia. It's great because the third sentence here, the only man to have been the pope on more than one occasion and the only man ever to have sold the papacy. How much do you want for this? I'm making you a great deal. Maybe he was Mario and he wanted out of the game.
That's what it was. He figured it out. He read the book. All right. So are we ready to move on to the news?
Oh, please. All right. First one I want to throw in here just because it's fun. This was one of my warm happies. So go out and head to your nearest bookstore or head over to Amazon and get yourself a copy. BBC Books have published a collection of Time Lord verse written by Whovian writer James Goss, whom we love, illustrated by Russell T. Davies in the style of Winnie the Pooh poetry. Now we are 600.
Nice.
I don't really have to say anymore. I mean, it's pretty much everything that you want. So, you know, the rhymes about Dalek master plans and everything. It's been a lot of fun. People have been like sharing snippets of it all through the week on Twitter and things. You can find little page grabs and stuff. Obviously, you can do the Amazon little preview walk, and it's a lot of fun. I put this on my Amazon list about the day that I heard it, and am anxiously awaiting the rights to be able to spend a couple of bucks to get a hardcover copy in the house. So once you are done enjoying some nice Whovian poetry, now you can have some pondering moments as to whether or not we will be seeing the last of Bill. We've been talking about actors, characters, who will be leaving with Moffat at the end of Series 10. Some just because they feel it's time. Others because they feel a sense of camaraderie, cast and crew alike. But I guess now it's not entirely a done deal that Pearl Mackey's going to leave at 10?
Yeah,
they just don't know at this point. Like, nobody knows.
She hasn't decided. They haven't said anything about it. So, yeah, it's just kind of one of those things that's up in the air.
I'm really enjoying her. I hope she sticks around for another season.
I genuinely think that there's a benefit to having a carryover companion.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not that it hasn't been executed well in both semblances, but I personally, whether it's you know, whether it's somebody who's watching throughout, or maybe someone who's just kind of picking up on it, because whoever ends up getting cast the 13th, you're going to have an influx of new viewers who want to see how this person, whoever they are, does with a role, but they don't know the story very well. So at least if you've got one person in there who gets what's, or at least has been prepared, Bill doesn't always really get what's going on, but if she's been prepared, or at least briefed by the close of Series 10 about what you're about to deal with, then there's a little bit of an audience benefit. We can't always rely on the Paternoster gang, although that would be great.
That would be awesome.
They're entirely Moffat's thing, but if he can't take all his toys with him.
He's taking his ball and he's going home.
Damn it. No, but she said, yeah, it's always a new adjustment. You're getting a new doctor. Inevitably, the dynamic is different because you're different actors and different characters. Interesting that this is coming from Mackie, who hasn't watched the show previously. So when she's saying, oh, it's a new adjustment getting a new doctor, as I've been told.
Yeah.
But no, I got to agree. I hope she sticks around because she's been rock solid. I've been enjoying everything we've gotten from her. Speaking of who could be the 13th Doctor, I know we try to shy away a lot from discussing who's in the running, not in the running. I'm mentioning this simply because they are on my short list, Richard Ayoade. So I think I might have mentioned him when we were talking about all of the betting odds and things. But for those of you, you know the IT crowd and series of that sort, or if you've watched the quiz show, he's got the quirkiness. He has the affability. He has a dark side, which isn't often seen. But he's he's sharp. He is wicked sharp, and can play goofy and really alien in his sense of humor at times. Kind of stunted. I'm not really sure if he's listening to what we're saying because he's kind of having his own conversation, but he's kind of involved. But I would have, oh my God, Ayoade and Pearl Mackey together?
Jeez.
Yes.
That would be interesting.
But yeah, we'll wait and see. I don't really know. At this point, it is so early, and everybody who's making any sort of suppositions is completely off their nut, but this is one I would love to see.
At this point, people saying that, you know, this person's in the front running is just, they're just trying to get that name out there and get people talking about it because nobody, yeah,
we have no clue. But this is a wish. This is one where I would put down my money before you even told me that the deal was signed. I would already be pre-purchasing my iTunes season and everything to go. One thing that we do know is in the bag because we're gonna get it in November. The Tylers are back, so we have confirmation from Big Finish that for the second season of the 10th Doctor's New Adventures, that we will have not only Billy Piper, but we will also have Camille Kadoori back in the recording studio. The trailer is available right in the Big Finish's news section. It's absolutely worth a listen. 2.5 minutes that you'll be very happy that you enjoyed. I'm not entirely certain where they're fitting this in or trying to sort of, you know, weave this into the chronology.
Yeah, it would have to take place somewhere in Series 2.
Yeah.
Yeah, just between the lines.
But yeah.
But we're involving our Ice Warriors here. We have it's not the, what are we dealing?
Have they confirmed that it's actually the 10th Doctor and not Handy Doctor?
No, this is the 10th Doctor.
Okay.
Yeah.
Based on working knowledge? Yes. The best part is we've got some great writers here. So we've got John Dorney, who has written some phenomenal Whovian work, both for screen and audio. Matt Fitton, who's just kills it every time he's writing for Big Finish. We absolutely love him. Guy Adams, I'm not as familiar with, but I know he's been doing substantial work for the audio team. And this just kind of dissolved the Whovian news for about 36 hours because everyone was so pleased that they got both Rose and Jackie Tyler back for a little bit more fun. And I'm extremely excited about it. So you can pre-order now. Get your limited edition if you want it on actual physical copy where you get 5 discs. They're only making 5,000 of these. All this great little, you know, book set packaging and whatnot. And then, and of course, if you just want it digitally, that's always easy. They make it super, super easy. It yes, automatically is available for you the moment that you make your point of purchase. And it's actually relatively inexpensive, you know. So we're talking about, what is it, if you buy it now, like now, you get it at like 50% off. It's like £15 for CD or is it, no, is it 12? £12.50 for download, $15 for the CD. So do your English conversion, American dollars. It's under $20. Hey,
right.
I did that right off the top of my head. Absolutely worth every penny, though. And then the great thing is when you're buying it this early, because it's not going to be available till November, you buy it now, and when it just shows up, you forgot you bought it, and it's like
great, an early Christmas present.
You did. Yeah. You sent yourself an email. How can you go wrong? All right, last bit on here. I just wanted to make sure that this was included because it's really, to me, this shows the levels that we don't, the levels of control over the program that we don't often really recognize. And that has to be the idea of kind of tying in broadcast and broadcast numbers, viewership to merchandising, merchandising to audience, audience present versus audience future. And Moffat actually referring to this as still a kids program. I don't think, reading through this, I don't think that this means that he considers it targeted as a kids program so much as it is one that has to be on a certain level approachable or digestible by a child audience. You know, they may not get everything out of it that we do when we get, you know, bogged down in the minutiae of the techno babble, but they understand the threats, the drama, the concerns, the relationships, the, you know, the ups and the downs, and monsters. Hey, so he said, you know, I always say that it's very important to appeal to children. You have to be able to draw the monster. And we talk a lot in the script meetings, by the way.
Right. Yeah.
Don't have a writer's room, but you have script meetings where they talk about what's the playground game. So what are the kids going to be playing next Monday? So when they go back to school.
This is where, you know, your Weeping Angels and your Silence fall in place.
Yeah. New versions of Freeze Tag where they're all Weeping Angels. If I can see you, you're frozen. So, and he says, you know, it's not to be taken simply. These are stories that can be very complicated and emotional, and you're supposed to sit up and watch it, but you have to keep in mind that the slightly different, more intense and more emotional way that children watch TV. And I really like that particular line. Children absorb things very differently than adults do because they have a limited set of previous experiences to be able to make connections to. So when you're presenting them with something that's highly dramatic or highly emotional or highly traumatic or highly emotionally charged, they may not have a frame of reference for that. So they interpret them very differently. And it's I can't imagine how difficult it is to take a program of this nature that involves science fiction and horror and mystery and comedy and all these things that it jumps through often within the course of a single story and actually put the thinking cap on and say, how does this play to a 10-year-old? How is this interpreted by a 14-year-old? That's an immense challenge that I would imagine to a certain degree only experience can really kind of can help embellish. But I'm thrilled that they think about it on this level.
Yeah, true. Yeah. Because, I mean, you don't want to alienate the kids because this is supposed to be a family show. So, you know, keeping it that, and one of the phrases, I can't remember which one it was that said it, but I believe it was one of the showrunners who at one point said, you know, you need to keep it simple enough for adults, but complex enough for kids. Mm. And I mean, that's true, but keeping it in that range, it is one of the things that has made the show so successful. And it's not an easy thing to do. It takes a lot of effort, but trying to differentiate yourself from, you know, a kid show is a difficult thing, and it's not going to be the heart of what Doctor Who is. So,
Well, Jay, you're at a particular advantage. I mean, you end up getting to see it. You've sat down and watched it with your boys that range a pretty good span of ages, mm-hmm. as far as just their cognitive processing and kind of what they draw from it. And so you can see, you know, your youngest maybe tends to, you know, focus on certain aspects of the nature of an episode production, whereas your eldest is really sort of, you know, working apart the complexities of the script and that sort of thing, right?
Oh, yeah. And watching it with them, I gain a lot more than I would watching it by myself because, you know, yeah, the six-year-old will sit there and he'll point something out. He's like, hey, did you notice that? And I'm like, I never would have picked up on that. Because that's not how I watch TV, but that's the only thing on screen for him. So yeah, there's a lot to be gained from watching it that way.
Yeah. So Haley, go get some kids.
Yeah.
No, I'm good. Thanks.
Just grab a few. There's gotta be a few of the apartment complex.
There's roving bands of children all over the place.
Exactly. Just grab a couple, sit down and be like, we're going to watch TV together.
No, that's why there's a lock on the door.
Just put a bowl of candy out the front door and say, hey, kids, you want to come watch TV with
no,
me?
No, that's okay.
It works out just fine.
All right. So next week, we will be coming back with the pyramid at the end of the world. So be interested to see how this comes in.
Well, knowing that this is only going to be a middle story, a lot of people actually didn't know this. There were a bunch of articles going around saying, hey, a surprise three-part. I'm like, nah, it wasn't really a surprise. But, well, yeah. I guess. I mean, if you weren't really kind of as dialed into it as we did.
We forget that not everyone is following the Doctor Who news like we do.
Shut up!
Not everyone has alarms set on their phone anytime anything with Doctor Who pops up on the internet?
No, I don't. That's what Kier's for.
Hey, guys, did you hear about this?
Way to ruin it for us, Kier.
Hey, Haley, I know it's a, you know, you're a different time zone and everything, and I'm, you know, texting you at 6 o'clock in the morning, but you hear about this? It's 8 and I've already had 2 cups of coffee.
Thanks a heap.
All right, well, this has been episode 234 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, oi, get off, I've just been executed, show a little respect.
This is Kier saying, wait, what is this about three brain stems? Muffet!
Their necks must be so big.
It's just giant necks. Kardashian necks.
And this is Haley saying, when I'm on a date, when that rare and special thing happens in my real life, do not, under any circumstances, put the Pope in my bedroom.
Nothing like Catholic guilt.
It's my favorite kind of foreplay. We'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.